Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
Awesome. And today, we have a very special guest that I've been very excited about for a while. We have Dr. Josh Schrout, who was my PhD advisor at the University of Notre Dame. And I'm very excited to have him here today. So thank you for coming to IUSB.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I have a few fun facts about Josh I wanted to share.
right off the bat.
Right off the bat, just right. So our audience can get to know who we have with us. Well, you, first of all, are from Wisconsin. So you are a fellow Midwesterner, Rust Belter.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So are you from Milwaukee?
Yes, I'm from the Milwaukee suburbs. I grew up in a suburb called Brown Deer, Wisconsin. But awesome. It's in the Milwaukee area for sure.
I wore a Milwaukee, Wisconsin shirt today just for you.
Yeah, Harley shirt.
Yeah.
Harley-Davidson. Did Harley-Davidson originate?
Oh, yeah. They're Milwaukee company still there. Big deal in Milwaukee.
But yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Are you a Brewers fan?
I am a Brewers fan.
Okay.
Especially now.
I guess, you know, we're recording this in late September, so the playoffs are going to be upon us soon.
Yeah. Right? And I do not follow them every day.
Yeah.
But I did see that they've clinched a playoff spot.
Awesome. I have no idea.
Yeah. It's baseball.
Baseball.
Yeah.
I don't know anything.
I only know it because when the weather starts turning, then it feels like baseball playoffs.
Oh, yeah, still don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so from Wisconsin, you are also a big lover of ice cream.
I am a big lover of ice cream. I think we can reference back to the Wisconsin part on that.
Yes,
yes. America's Dairyland. But yeah, I like ice cream.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, anytime we've gone anywhere, we go find ice cream. I feel like we've gone to conferences and all that.
Right.
We end up getting ice cream.
Now, I will say I'm not specific to ice cream because I'll do custard or gelato.
Okay.
But so, ice cream-like things.
Yeah.
Big fan.
Are you open to different flavors or is there like a go-to?
Yeah, I'm definitely open to different flavors.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I see. So like chocolate, vanilla, strawberry.
Yeah. What's your go-to?
Yeah.
I don't really have a go-to.
Okay.
I think by default, I look for something with some kind of fruit in it,
mm-hmm.
but I'm usually looking for something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
I change frequently.
Okay.
Cookie dough is fine.
That's a good one.
Know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's solid.
Can't go wrong with that.
Usually with cookie dough.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On that note, we got ice cream in Wisconsin once and you made us walk very, very far. Josh is also a very fast walker. This is just something that I've had to deal with while I was in your lab. We'd go places. Very fast walker.
Yeah. Fun fact. Yeah. It's true. I'm not dawdling around.
Yeah.
Like to get there and then.
Especially if there's ice cream at the end of the road.
There was ice cream promised and then delivered.
You promised cows and there was no cows.
That's true. So we were at the University of Wisconsin, Madison.
The story keeps getting better.
And they, they have their own ag school.
Of course.
So they have their own cows and then they have their own dairy. And you can go see the dairy. But the cows, I've learned, you kind of need an appointment. And we didn't do that ahead of time.
No.
So
the cows were all booked up that day. And Maggie, did you mention that Josh was your PhD advisor?
I think I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I've known Josh for many, many years now.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've spent a lot of time with him both on campus and then traveling
to conferences
and things like that. So this is why I'm sharing some of my, most of my guests, I don't have this kind of insider information about who this person is. One last fun fact that also kind of goes on the heels of being a fast walker. If you see Josh on campus, he's probably fast walking to Trader Joe's. There's a 63% chance if you go to Trader Joe's here in town, you will see Josh.
63.
That's kind of my rough estimate.
That's about a two-thirds. Okay.
Maybe buying a new flavor of sparkling water that you like to share with the lab.
I didn't know Maggie knew me quite that well, but these are all true.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of a running joke. It's like, oh yeah, Josh, we saw him at Trader Joe's. Never see him, in his office, but we are more likely to see you at Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Because it's right next to campus, so
now that our lab's, in the northeast corner of campus, it's a little over a 20-minute walk, under 25-minute walk for me to go to Trader Joe's.
like 40 minutes for normal 40 walkers. Minutes,
yeah, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hence the fast walk. Yeah. I got to get this done in under an hour. So I got to get there and get back. And then, And then I'm, you know, I'm still a scientist. So I still hide in my office and eat that lunch.
Right. That's right.
Behind closed doors.
That's what you do.
That's what I do.
Yeah. So I just thought that's kind of who we have here. Ice cream loving, Trader Joe loving. Always
fast walking,
always
scientist.
Going somewhere. Yeah. Usually Trader Joe's.
Very good.
Josh is also one of the kindest people I know, one of my favorite people to get to hang out with, and one of my favorite scientists. I think you're a brilliant scientist. I joined your lab because of your approach to science. I didn't really care about bacteria or microbiology, but I met you and was like, this is who I want to learn from for my PhD. So I'm very excited to have you here.
And that's very kind. Thank you.
It's all true. I'm very grateful. You've really shaped my career in a huge way. You're always very generous with advice. You've given me some of the best advice that I still give to people now as I'm working with students. So I told you, I was like, I'm going to cry because I'm just very grateful. I'm very grateful for you. You are one of my favorite people to get to talk to and not talk about science, even just talk about life. I think you have a really a lot to offer people. So I'm very excited our listeners get to hear from you today.
Well, it goes both ways because, you know, the time spent with you has been not just about science, right? You're an interesting person. So so I've learned a lot by you doing your science, but, you know, getting to know you has also been an enjoyable thing, right?
Oh, so, that's good to hear. Yeah. A lot of people have not great relationships with their PhD advisors.
It's true.
It can be, I know Shahir has shared on here before, not the best relationship with your advisor.
Not the best. Yeah.
So I'm very grateful because that's shaped then how I interact with other scientists, that it doesn't have to be this torturous, stressful thing. Obviously, we've bumped heads at times, as it's normal, but... Yeah.
Which I told you ahead of time.
Yeah.
It was going to happen.
Yeah. Writing a paper with you is awful.
Yeah.
That's a whole new side of Josh that I didn't know. But I'm very grateful, and that's... and I know you've been intentional about that, and you've told me how intentional you choose to mentor students. I don't think this is a question that we had on our list, but I've always appreciated you talking about your mentoring style and how you interact with the students that you've worked with. Can you talk a little bit about that and your approach to working with PhD students? You have undergrads and master's students as well. So
yeah. Well, I guess when a new person comes into the lab, so from the research side, I try to work with the student and pitch one or two ideas on, like, this is what I was thinking you could work on. These are things we're working on in the lab. This is something we'd like somebody else to work on. So oftentimes, as you know now at your stage, right, these are offshoots of other people's projects. But we kind of like to scratch the surface on this, find out if it's worth investigating further. So this is what I would have you do. And as we do that, we teach a few of the basic things that everybody in the lab knows how to do. So some of this is really basic stuff, how to streak a plate and isolate bacteria. Everybody's a microbiologist, somehow does this. But then we typically do assays in my lab that very few labs do. So if I have somebody who's, they come in and I don't know how to do anything you do. Like, nobody knows how to do stuff that we do in my lab. There's a few things that we do that really nobody else does.
Right.
So that doesn't bother me because I know we're going to have to teach them that. So while we're trying to work on some particular project, we're teaching a few basic steps. So then I tell them, so you're going to work on this for a few weeks, maybe a couple months, and then we're going to kind of reassess, like, is this going okay? Are you interested in this at all? Do you hate this? Do you hate the lab, or, you know, it's not going well with me and we should just part ways? Or like, well, like parts of it, but I don't actually like this at all. I'm not curious about this. Or has the whole thing just been a train wreck? I don't feel like I'm learning anything, right? So each of those gives a point to then reassess and maybe start over or cut it off or whatever. But then, I tell people that they should be communicating with me in a written way, you know, like send me something in a report form once a month.
Right.
I said, but if you're a new student or a finishing student, I know I'm going to see you more often than that. You're going to be in my office like more than once a month to talk about your report. You're going to be in my office like every week or every day.
Yeah.
And I'm in the lab a fair amount. It ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah, I'll say you are one of the few PIs that actually has a bench in the lab and actively does stuff in the lab pretty regularly, which is super cool.
That is cool. And it's quite rare.
Yeah.
I like all the new undergrads to go through me first. It doesn't always work out that way, but for the most part, it does. So I'm the one who shows them the first three steps that they're going to do. Mm-hmm.
So it seems like what's really important to you is the interest level of the student in what they're doing in the lab.
The interest level of the student, I want to make sure that they feel like they're part of it.
Right.
I think one of the things that is now, so this is my 19th year at Notre Dame. So I've gone through kind of like a few iterations of this, and I've realized I actually still really like it, which is great to feel that way.
Yeah. After 2 decades. Yeah.
Yeah. There've been years or semesters, you know, whether it's in academic terms or life terms, where I've felt like I'm just kind of dialing it in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then something will happen that I'll like, no, I actually really, really like this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I realize I'm still really fortunate that this is what I get to do.
Mm-hmm.
So with that comes the fact that I like when the research group functions, you know, that they get along.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be best friends. Right. Mm-hmm. That'd be fine. But I'm not trying to like broker relationships in that regard, but I am trying to foster a healthy work environment that actually benefits everybody, right? If they get curious and they feed off each other and they know they can ask each other questions rather than thinking that they're competing against each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I've seen environments like that and I just absolutely want to avoid that.
Yeah. And I guess that's a very important point because, you know, for our lovely listeners who are not in the scientific world or in the science world, it seems like what you're doing should be just what everybody's doing. But as it turns out, that's not always the case because there are a lot of labs where you have one project and many people working on it.
Yeah.
And whoever gets it first, they get the publication, they get the paper.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of cutthroat.
Yeah, I don't have personal experience with that, but I've seen it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just like, oh, that just looks terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
It doesn't have to be that way. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. But you're more interested in building a community that is the lab.
Yeah.
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 Well, Maggie, you wanted to say something.
I feel like you've mentioned in the past to me that you kind of intentionally tried to keep a small lab in some ways. Part of that is funding, right? If you don't have funding for a big lab, you can't have a big lab. But I feel like you've been very intentional with how your lab looks and operates. And you partner with a lot of other researchers as well. We'll get into your actual research here in a second, but you partner with professors on Notre Dame campus, collaborate across universities as well to allow for that kind of smaller environment where you can rely on other labs without having all the personnel yourself. Is that fair to say that you kind of have intentionally done that?
Yeah, I think we're trying to work on and then answer interesting questions.
Mm-hmm.
So that usually necessitates that there's expertise that we don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So however it is we need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's that I meet somebody interesting and like, hey, let's try to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it could just as easily be, you know, the student or other trainee is like, you know, I've found this, I want to do this. So then we go, well, how are we going to get an answer for that?
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So very much question driven as opposed to other
technique driven.
Technique driven. Yeah.
So maybe we should find out a little bit more about your research.
Yeah.
I think that would be very interesting.
Yeah.
So you're a microbiologist, at least nowadays.
I'm an engineer turned microbiologist.
Engineer turned microbiologist. I think that's actually very interesting because you started your life as an engineer. You're still an engineer.
Yeah.
Right. And something happened. And then
what happened?
What happened that basically made you interested in bacteria?
Yeah. So as a high school student, then new college student, I was pretty convinced I should be an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Just that was what I thought I knew, and I was decent at science and math, so I should do engineering. And high school turned out to have been a bit too easy, so that when I get to college, I didn't know how to study.
Yeah.
So that was a rough transition. But things worked out eventually, but not until my senior year of undergrad did I take a microbiology class. Yeah. So as a environmental engineering undergrad, it's a lot of chemistry and applied chemistry. And then, oh, by the way, you know, microbes might be something that as environmental engineers, we either need to deal with and get rid of, or actually try to have them work to our advantage. Right. Right? It could go either way, depending on what specific problem we're interested in. So for the midterm exam in my first microbiology class, I know I got the lowest score in the class. And after that, I was in the professor's office hour every opportunity.
Yeah.
So that was my introduction to microbiology.
Yeah. Lowest grade.
Lowest grade.
And
needing a lot of help.
Yeah.
And I'm not shy about telling students mm-hmm. about this now, because, I mean, it's not a bad thing to not do well, because it's an opportunity to maybe change how things are going.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you went from lowest grade on a microbiology exam to a microbiology professor, basically.
Right? Essentially, yeah.
So,
but it took well over a decade to
well over a decade.
Do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened during that decade?
Yeah. So finished my bachelor's degree in environmental engineering, and then worked in consulting for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Thought about going back to graduate school and on the engineering side to do a master's degree as a normal thing to do.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Started a master's degree, and that was when I really did laboratory research. So I'm like, oh, I love this.
Yeah.
If I could just do this, that's what I would do.
Yeah.
So then looked to do a PhD, also still in environmental engineering, and wanted to work with somebody I'd met at a conference, and he was co-author of a textbook that environmental engineers used, and saw him give this interesting talk. So what I was interested in that time when I started my PhD was pollutant degradation.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So chemical spills.
How to break down these harmful chemicals.
Harmful chemicals. Uh-huh. That was what everybody in the lab was working on. And I found that super cool and useful, and that would be a great thing to do. Well, as part of that, I had a fellowship at the University of Iowa that basically, the engineers and the scientists kind of intermingled. Mm-hmm. So I took microbiology, I took bacterial genetics, mm-hmm. I took some other microbe courses, and then still went back and did my pollutant degradation research. But I'd been now a bit more exposed to this world of like some of the details of microbes, not just treating them as buckets of pollutant degrading stuff, but mm-hmm. like, oh, each of these microbes actually has some specific traits that we know or we don't know, and that could be really important understanding the pollutant degradation side. So then as I was finishing my PhD and had dabbled a bit more in microbiology, found myself wondering exactly what I was going to do next. Huh. And that was when the postdoc research opportunity kind of pretty close fell in my lap.
Yeah.
And I just decided to go for it.
Wonderful.
I skipped over a few more logical steps. So other peers of mine kept doing pollutant degradation things, yeah. and some in microbiology, some more on the engineering side, mm-hmm. whereas I just started working on these things called biofilms, mm-hmm. and we were going to do pure culture work, which was already ongoing. It was just brand new to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I shifted a bit more steeply from engineering over to bacterial genetics and basic microbiology, and then looking at bacterial biofilms. And
yeah. So tell us, what is a biofilm?
Yeah. So biofilms are an attached growth state of microbes. So I'm usually thinking of, I'm a bacterial centric kind of person. So I'm usually thinking of bacteria, but it wouldn't have to be bacteria.
Yeah.
So these are, microbial mats at Yellowstone National Park.
Okay.
These are weird orange pink stuff that forms on shower curtains in bathrooms.
Right. Yeah. If you, mm-hmm. you that's know, a biofilm.
That's a biofilm.
Wonderful.
So any kind of attached growth state of some microbe, so slippery rocks and, you know, mountain streams and stuff, these are bacterial biofilms. That was actually how that term was first used by researchers in Montana. Mm-hmm. They talked about these biofilms that form on mountain streams, rocks and mountain streams.
So these are living things that are clumping together into a layer of some sort that grows on something static and has some sort of food source to keep it going.
Yeah. So in flowing systems, then the nutrients just pass them by and they are getting out what they can. But it doesn't have to be in a system with flow, but it, you know, it has to be hydrated in some way.
Right.
But however, and these biofilms can be good or bad.
Right.
So usually from a human point of view and an infection point of view, we're thinking them as bad. Every day we have a biofilm in our mouth. That's why we should brush our teeth. So when you feel that stuff, you know, in mid to late afternoon or whatever timing you're on, you know, I mean, that's a biofilm in your own mouth.
So teeth and tongue and
But, you know, weird stuff that forms on wounds, these are usually bacterial biofilms. And lung infections, we know that these are usually bacterial biofilms.
Urinary tract infections also?
Urinary tract infections also going to be biofilms predominantly.
Predominantly. Yeah. So these are going to be layers of bacteria usually.
And it, they're curious, but then they're also, they behave differently than microbes floating around in a test tube. They literally have different gene expression patterns that then can lead to interesting behaviors or very serious and bad behaviors if we're talking about pathogens.
So you're making a distinction between a bacteria that's just kind of floating around in a liquid environment, not really attached to any of its friends, and the bacteria, same bacteria, but now connected to its bacteria friends, same species, maybe different species. And now they're forming a biofilm, and they're going to behave differently, even though they're genetically the same.
Yes.
Because of their environment.
Because of their environment. So there's, you know, now several decades of research on this general questions of biofilms. So some are indeed like essentially pure species. It's one single species. Others are definitely going to be mixed communities. So within those mixed communities, there's probably some push and pull, you know, some cooperation and some fighting that occurs. But yes, we know distinctly in some ways, and in other ways, there remain a lot of unknowns. How are they either cooperating or fighting? And then to discern, yes, they're definitely behaving differently than they would in the test tube.
So I just want to make a distinction for our lovely listeners here.
Yeah.
The difference between the term that we might use, like different species of bacteria versus different strains of bacteria. How would you describe the difference between, you know, different strains versus different species of bacteria?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, using classic phylogenetic naming of, you know, genus, species, right? Yeah. So what did I learn it as? King Philip Cough's Green Snot, kingdom, order, family.
Kingdom,
class,
order, phylum.
Order, class, phylum, genus, species. So usually in most biological naming and certainly microbiology, we're referring just to genus and species.
Right.
So Staphylococcus aureus, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Escherichia, E. coli, right?
Yeah.
So those are genus and species names. But then within each of those species, there's going to be strain differences. And sometimes the strain differences are just like kind of a esoteric geekdom of like, hey, this strain's different than this and I can prove it to you.
Yeah.
But other times these have great importance that certain strains are different from others.
Right.
And again, that can affect either environmental relevance or infection.
Or infection. So so we hear about E. coli a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, E. coli naturally grows in our gut. The coli, I think, was named because it's in our colon.
Yeah, right? I think that's right.
Yeah. But then there are different strains that are going to be disease-causing or pathogenic. Would you say that that's an accurate statement?
Yeah, yeah, that's great, Shahir. Yeah, because you need E. coli to survive. You need it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's, it does a lot of good work for you. Yeah. There are, you know, there are coenzymes and factors that your body can't make. Yeah. Your, you know, eukaryotic cells can't make these, but bacteria like E. coli can.
Yeah.
And so you need those strains. But then there are those... you know, pathogenic strains. So the ones that catch our attention are the ones that show up in food or, you know, vegetables or meat, right? And those are enter hemorrhagic ones that cause intestinal disease.
Right.
And then there are other specific strain types that can cause other diseases of E. coli. But, you know, probably over 99% of E. coli that we know about are totally harmless. And in fact, you need them to survive.
They're even useful.
We should not rid the planet of E. coli. That would be a big problem.
So E. coli are just one species, but they have different strains. But then you can, so back to the biofilm, you know, the idea of a biofilm that you can have the same species, maybe the same species with different strains.
Yeah.
But also... multiple species or more than one species of bacteria that are kind of hanging on together and kind of clumping together.
Yeah.
Right. And what are they doing? I mean, you've actually used a lot of these terms like cooperating and fighting, which are very human things.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the things that, you know, just reading about what your work, you study things like socio-microbiology.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is, you know, sociology is typically something that we attribute to humans. And,
sure.
and some of the words that you use, like fighting and cooperating, those are very human things. Can we see that in bacteria? Because we usually think of bacteria as just like, you know, it's a bacteria. It just divides and then it goes away and then that's it.
Right.
They don't have personalities, right? But do they?
Well, I'm not going to go so far as personalities.
Okay.
At least. But at least we don't have evidence of that yet.
Yeah.
So maybe they do, but
maybe
I'm not going to assert personalities. But yes, they definitely exhibit social traits. So one of them is well known, and I happen to know you two have both written about it. Quorum sensing is a social trait exhibited by bacteria where they emit signals. So one bacterium makes a chemical signal, and it's only the signal only becomes an activator when there's enough of their friends around.
Right.
So each bacterium makes a little bit, but it has to be a high enough concentration of signal. So these quorum sensing molecules, these signal molecules, originally called autoinducers.
Right.
So each bacterium makes a little bit. But then only when a certain threshold is reached, which means that there's enough of just not just you, but your neighbors all making enough signal to then make the threshold level, right? So this was shown in this marine bacterium, Vibrio fischeri, that it contributes to, it's required to make bioluminescence. So these bacteria glow blue.
Wow.
Yeah.
Super cool.
And that was interesting, right? That was like, oh, isn't that cool science stuff?
Yeah.
But not so many people cared.
Right, because it's just the bacteria in the ocean that just glows blue for some squid or something.
Well, then with the onset of, you know, more sequencing capabilities and starting to look at homology between genomes, we realized, oh, all these pathogens have this same homologous type of mechanism. They're making these signal molecules. They're not making blue light. They're turning on things that make us sick.
And that's so when you get people interested.
That's where the funding comes in.
Many more people became interested, but it's basic microbiology in either way, so it's worthwhile to investigate. So those molecules are known, even though we don't know everything about them. It's well established that they exist, and to continue to investigate some of the nuances of these things actually still continue to blow my mind.
So this really brings us back to the importance of biofilm and having that community of bacteria, because together, in a sense, they can cooperate, as you use the term, to produce a signal, and now they have a threshold that can all of a sudden turn on this, you know, pathogenic response or this pathogenic effect.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, your slip of the tongue there is also correct, because sometimes they turn stuff off.
Yeah.
So it was originally described as turning things on, but it could go either direction.
Right.
Like, however it is they sense what they interpret they should be doing, right? That's why somebody like me can study this. These bacteria don't have neurons. Mm-hmm. There's every decision is hardwired.
Right.
Even though we actually don't understand what they all are. Mm-hmm. So there's the opportunity to perhaps understand it all.
Yeah.
Without worrying about psychology. It's just these bacteria are just hardwired to do this. We still don't understand it.
Yeah.
But we understand some of it, so we keep going. And there's a ton of curiosity. But so as they're surrounded by either friends or frenemies or enemies, but neighbors, they're going to be sensing each other's signaling molecules, but they're sensing other things about, nutrients that are nearby or not, what they're attached to as they do this. All these different things seem to matter. And that's where a lot of the new discovery needs to come, I think.
This is fascinating. I have like a million other questions.
Well, you can keep asking. I'm letting you ask questions because I did. My whole PhD was studying a lot of these things. Right. So I remember this. But I just actually taught my graduate seminar course I'm teaching about quorum sensing this week. So they had a lot of interesting questions about what kind of traits we can ascribe to bacteria from a sociological lens, right? This idea of motivations. They're like, well, isn't surviving a motivation? Because, right, like you said, they don't have personalities there's no evidence for that. But we are kind of towing this line of how we talk about these social behaviors. And then they're like, well, do they have, right? They're not acting maliciously, but they are also kind of acting maliciously. And this idea of the motivations, and do they have morals and ethics? So it's an interesting discussion when we're talking about the bacterial behavior. Maybe I don't know where I'm going with this question.
And these are non-science.
These are non-science students.
So they're humanity students. So I think that really brings it into that realm of who are these bacteria and why are they doing, like, what's the social motivation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I have my most complex example that I can offer, and we've now published this in two different ways, so they're related in my mind, but the papers are different, is that we actually have some evidence that the bacterial species that we work with most often, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, can display some altruistic traits. And that, again, just that seems crazy.
That is mind blowing that bacteria can just kind of self sacrifice.
We have evidence that this certain kind of chemical communication behavior leads them to make so much of a molecule that can act as a toxin at high enough concentrations. And some of them will kill themselves off.
Wow.
But when we look at the numbers, the areas where some have died leads to overall increased numbers of population. Because if we look at mutants that don't make these, overall more die.
Mm-hmm. So it's a surprising survival result of the species over the survival of the individual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's some version of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I told my students this, they were really kind of mind blown, right? Because killing yourself as a bacterial cell kind of goes against this survivor motivation that we kind of, they just want to survive at any cost. And this idea that they have a sense of survival of their community is a really novel idea. It does then, again, like I said, toe this interesting line of how we can talk about them and how mindful we have to be about ascribing motivations. But it's kind of a fun mental exercise as well to kind of, and I think it can change how we ask research questions if we let ourselves cross that line a little bit.
Yeah.
But some people don't like that.
No, well, and I think that's the stage that we're at from the pure science point is a bit of hand waving. Like, well, the data show us just in counting cells that clearly this is what happens. And that part I'm very sure of. But then, is there actual motivation? I'm much less sure of that.
Yeah,
and that's also a very important point, because just from an evolutionary point of view, if a population survives, they will continue to survive unless otherwise.
Yeah.
Right. And even if that comes at the cost of individuals within that bacterial group,
right?
Those genes even though they're harmful to some individuals,
right,
that species will proliferate, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And they'll survive over whatever billions of years that the bacteria have been around.
That seems like normal evolution.
Yeah, right? It's normal evolution. Mm-hmm. So we could see it from our own human-centric way of, oh, this is altruistic because we are very individualistic,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But just on a very basic level, from a biology, basic biology level, this is just evolution. The genes that propagate the population will survive.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And genes that don't impact you also will continue. If they don't harm you, they're going to show up, and they might not have a specific purpose. And we kind of are looking for one when it might not be there as obviously.
They'll be there.
Ask these questions all the time to myself and to people in the lab. You know, just because you're not seeing the expected result, it actually could be because we're doing the wrong experiment, right? Like, is there a way we could test it differently? Because some microbes grow under a variety of different environments. They're not such specialists that they'll only grow in one place. So there are microbes that really only ever grow in one place.
Right.
But those that grow in the environment and can grow any human and can infect a plant, that means they're set up to do all those different things.
Right.
Whereas in the lab, we tend to start with one particular experiment we're really comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's often sets us up to not see something.
Yeah. Just because of the constructs or the constraints of your experiment, you're not seeing the whole picture.
We're
always going to be in that place as scientists one way or another because we can't replicate the entire world.
We cannot replicate the entire world. Yeah. And sometimes that's a missed opportunity because we should be looking at it, maybe even not way differently, just slightly differently.
Slightly different. Yeah. So it's about asking a better question.
Yeah.
Would you say that?
Better or a different question.
A different question.
Sometimes the different question, we afterwards tell ourselves it was a better question. But it's a different question for sure.
Asking a different question.
Yeah. Yeah, the way you talk about setting up a different experiment was one of the reasons I really enjoyed working in your lab, because I'd never really thought about testing things that way of, well, we have this really constrained lab environment and we're missing a lot of things.
Yeah.
How can we introduce those back into the lab environment in a controlled way, following the scientific method, but test things that actually exist in the real world, right? We talked about most bacteria exist in some type of biofilm. They don't grow in tubes shaken at 280 RPM at 37 degrees for 18 hours, right? But that's how we test things.
Yeah.
And so I liked that idea of being able to be a little bit more creative in the lab and you giving space for that. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit specifically about the research that you do in your lab, which haven't been in there for a couple of years, so maybe there's new cool things happening, and how you address those questions of how can we recreate the actual environment in a lab setting. So
sure.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm going to start by actually going back a couple of decades. So when I started doing biofilm research myself as a postdoc researcher, the challenge was to be able to grow bacterial biofilms, which other people had done, but we were collaborating with an applied mathematician who was had written models to describe the onset of this quorum sensing chemical communication within these biofilms.
Mm-hmm.
And so my postdoc advisor, Matt Parsick, he said, well, this is going to be easier for all of us if you grow flat, uniform biofilms because, you know, the math isn't really in full 3D yet.
Right.
So you're going to want to do that. And there's not a consensus view on how this works. But he's like, but I think it has to do with the nutrient environment. It's not like presence or absence. It's like literally if you have one carbon source over another, right? Again, these bacteria could use different things to grow. They could use glucose. They could use amino acids. They could use other compounds. So it's like, I think that's part of the key. So that was how it all started, that I was trying to recreate growing flat biofilms in the lab and switching carbon sources to do this.
Yeah.
And then what I saw as a part of that was differences in their surface motility.
Right.
as they were growing to make these biofilms, and that then spawned what I worked on and continue to work on in some ways, is just as part of biofilm development, how do these microbes move on surfaces? They're sensing all kinds of nutrient and other cues, and they can move around a lot or move around very little, and that's part of what is curious. But as I learned things as part of that, those few years, others in the lab were working on different things, and like, so you're going to want to do this kind of assay, and this is the paper that's published on this. And it seemed like every assay that was in the literature at the time was using a different media to grow the bacteria.
And the media is just the food that you give.
And the media is the food, right? Yeah. So a default medium would be, Luria broth that will grow all kinds of microbes, or tryptic soy broth, or common rich media that grow a ton of microbes.
Yeah.
A lot of antibiotic testing is actually, screening is done in Miller-Hinton broth. Mm-hmm. There's other minimal media. So everybody has these different media that they use for one reason or not. Some are good reasons, others just because, the person before me did this. So on my bench, like, I have these three different assays I'm supposed to do, and they're all using different media. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why am I going to do that? I want to understand. I need to do all these assays in the same media. Otherwise, I'm not going to believe the result.
Right, because you can only really change one thing at a time. If you're changing the assays and changing the media, then you really don't know which one is actually contributing to the difference.
But at that time, nobody thought of it that way. Mm-hmm. They were like, we just need to do the assay, and then we'll see the result, and then we can compare it back. I'm like, well, that seems crazy to me.
Yeah.
So I just set out to like try to do the assays in the one medium that I was using. And I got a really nice paper out of that and got a job. So, right. I mean, that was like just changing the experiment.
Yeah.
As actually trying to do the same thing that other people had done dozens, if not hundreds of times, but just
trying something different.
To, as opposed to tackling it from a genetics point of view, which I was very weak at the time. So that played to my strengths was like, I'm not going to solve this with bacterial genetics. I'm just going to solve this with chemistry, and even then, this is just like making media. This is like me in a balance and, Weibo.
Weighing stuff, Weighing stuff, dissolve it in water, and then just feed it to the bacteria.
Just feed it. So that was how things kind of got started.
Yeah.
And then the lab continues to operate that way, right? So, and there's a lot of relevance to this, actually. So there's well-published from lung infection literature that amino acids in particular are really important for Pseudomonas aeruginosa lung infections. But most people don't study those as specific. So we're missing a lot to understand behavior that's probably really important, because we're frequently still growing them on rich media that actually isn't relevant to any infection or the natural environment or anything. It's just a good way to grow a lot of cells, but it's they're going to behave differently. So we start from that point, and now we've done things like vary those nutrients, but then also vary surfaces. And so various assays that we use, like, well, what if we just change this one thing? And several times over now, we've seen some remarkable behavior when we change just one thing.
That's fantastic. So I do have one question about the term that you used, which is surface motility. And that's it sounds on the surface that pun intended here, that it's just bacteria moving on a surface,
right?
But my question is, as I visualize this, obviously the bacteria are not making some sort of monolayer. There's not just one layer of bacteria on some sort of surface, because if you can see it, it's multiple layers of bacteria.
Right.
And so what you mean by surface motility is that how the bacteria are moving on that plastic or porcelain surface, or is it the bacteria at the very top, the very surface of the biofilm, and how they're moving, or is it both?
It could be both. We've done stuff where they're not yet one layer thick. They're actually pretty sparse.
Yeah.
And they're going to be one layer and then multiple layers thick. So this goes back 2010. So it's coming up on 15 years.
Oh my God.
we published a paper with a collaborator where we described a bacterial walking.
Yeah.
So single cells will use their type 4 pili, and the rod-shaped cell will orient upright, and they'll kind of like hobble around on their appendages and...
All right. Okay. Hold the phone. All right. Hold the phone. So pili are these appendages.
Yeah.
Right. They're kind of like hair.
Yeah. They're kind of like hair.
And when you say them, the rod shape, they look like a pill essentially.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so they're kind of oblong.
Think of them as capsules.
A capsule. Yeah. Right. Yeah. A capsule of some sort. So they will... On the surface, they're kind of laying down on the side the way that a capsule would just kind of fall on the surface of the table.
Right.
But what they'll do is they'll prop themselves up.
They'll prop themselves, they'll orient upright.
And then along these appendages, these pili that look like little hairs, they will walk like a stick figure kind of thing.
Yeah, they look like drunken sailors. Oh. They wobble around. They don't necessarily go in a straight line, but they'll...
You see this like with a microscope.
Oh yeah, we can see it
now that like a movie,
right? Yeah. So it was,
that's amazing.
And this was cool. This was the first great thing that I was part of as not just the researcher, but now an advisor. So somebody I'd met before was Gerard Wong is now at UCLA, but. At that time, he was still at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And he called me and he said, well, I have this group of senior undergrads that need a bioengineering senior design project. Mm-hmm. And I remembered you showing me some of your time-lapse movies of bacterial moving around on surfaces. Like, do you have more of those?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, no, but we can make more. So... Mm-hmm. One of the first undergrads to join my lab at Notre Dame, Dominic Motto, he learned these flow cells from me. I showed him how to do everything, and then he improved it quickly. he generated a bunch of data. We sent it off to the collaborators, and then Gerard called me back a few months later. He's like, well, they've seen a cool pattern, and they think some of the bacteria are cartwheeling.
Oh, wow.
And this turned out to be a super small fraction, but it really caught their attention.
Yeah.
So then he put more people on the project and we did a bit more sophisticated analysis to track through all of it. But when we knew what we were looking for, then we could set up assays to specifically look for it. And indeed, we'll see these bacteria orient upright and
walk around and do cartwheels. So bacteria learn to walk upright way before our ancestors did it.
I do not know the evolutionary time at which this occurred, but that could be correct.
Could be good, since bacteria have been around for a long time. So, right. You know, this is possibly something they've been doing for billions of years. Possibly.
It's possible.
It's possible. Yeah. But they could have also just learned it, you know, like, you know, a few thousand
years
ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. That's fascinating. And doing cartwheel. So every time I see somebody doing a cartwheel, I don't know if I can do a cartwheel anymore.
But I can't.
I haven't tried.
Yeah.
I'm not going to risk it.
No. The knees.
Yeah. The knees would not.
The knees. But.
So that's single cell
surface
motility. Wow. But we also work on what happens when there's thousands and probably millions of cells. Mm-hmm. Indeed, they are layers thick.
Yeah.
But they're behaving as groups, because without the group, they won't do it to spread in certain kinds of ways.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for the whole history of me working on these kinds of questions, I've been interested in these range of scales of single cell up to groups and what's driving whatever it is that we see at any given time.
So they're moving together as a group along a surface the way like a glacier would be moving.
That's a great analogy, actually, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just trying to visualize it, because a glacier looks kind of solid, but it's also moving.
Yeah, they'll make these tendril-like patterns.
Wow.
So it involves a lot of chemistry and chemical engineering. Uh-huh. Surface tension is huge.
Yeah, on that scale.
On
I
that
imagine,
scale,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, surface tension is huge. Wow, amazing.
Yeah. I know. I miss working with all those. It's super fun. I'm a bit nostalgic. You also work with a bacterium, Myxococcus xanthus, correct?
Yeah.
Or you have in the past?
I have in the past.
This is a super, super cool bacterium. I never worked with it, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about it, because it is one of the bacterium that is a model for some of these socio-microbiology questions and exhibits some pretty cool behavior.
Yeah, Myxococcus xanthus is a soil bacterium. Yeah. Won't affect anything. But that said, if you have a other favorite bacterium of yours, Myxococcus xanthus will probably eat it. Wow. So almost anything that's another bacterium, Myxococcus xanthus will consider it as prey.
Oh my
gosh. So it's one of the bacteria in the soil that can degrade parts of woody plant material.
Yeah.
So it uses a bit more complex carbon sources as food. It's actually pretty poor at growing on something like glucose. It likes more, chains of polysaccharides and things like that. So in that way, it loves to use whole other bacteria as food.
Wow.
John Kirby, who's now at the Medical College of Wisconsin, this is a while ago, but described pretataxis for Myxococcus xanthus and showed that if you just put a spotty E. coli on a plate, Myxococcus xanthus will like move into it and just consume it.
It tracks it down, hunts it down, and eats it.
Yeah, it senses it and then, tracks it down and eats it.
Is Myxococcus any bigger, any larger in size than like our standard good old lab E. coli?
Yeah, maybe twice the size.
Twice the size.
Okay. So up to 10 microns long compared to 2-3 microns long. Not all cells are always that long. It's a little longer.
So a bully that will eat you.
Yeah. Maybe tall and lanky.
Okay.
And then if you get it agitated, it'll eat you.
Come for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can find videos online of this behavior where they just kind of swarm. All across these E. coli colonies pretty rapidly.
Well, that's the thing. These are time-lapse movies.
That's
Myxococcus xanthus is among the slowest bacteria that are considered to be motile. So those movies are always
sped up.
Yeah.
But
it's absolutely fascinating because they'll show all these rippling-like behaviors that I've not seen for any other bacterial species. So it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but no one's documented it, that how these... The patterns that it makes when you watch Myxococcus xanthus over a few hours are just, they're mesmerizing.
Yeah. It really is. Yeah. I encourage people to look. Maybe I'll post some on this episode show notes.
I think that'd be fun. Yeah.
And I think you have a video of the walking on your lab website.
I do.
Too. So
yeah,
we can maybe link that so people can see it.
Well, so
it's pretty cool.
We have a question for you. Mm. Since you work on groups of bacteria.
Yeah.
We know that, groups of fish are called schools of fish.
Yeah.
Right. Crows are a murder of crows. Whales are pods. What is a group of bacteria called? Is there a name for it? Or should we just make one up?
I think we should. I don't believe there's a name for
it. We should do it.
So, if we can come up with a name, that would be a good idea.
All right. I mean, all I can think of is like a colony, but a colony is a very specific...
Yeah, that's
already bacteria.
That's already taken.
Yeah, because
a spot of microbes
on a petri plate. So they kind of grew from the same cells, just dividing over and over and over and over, where you can see it.
Yeah,
but a group of bacteria that maybe didn't all come from the same, single cell. We should come up with a name.
Yeah, I think we should.
All right. All right. Yeah. Well, we'll split the profit. 50-50.
Okay.
How about that? Okay.
All right. 50-50.
Sure, Maggie's still here.
Sorry, Maggie.
You guys are just forgetting that.
Oops.
I know.
It'll work out because on the Nobel Prize, they only list three names.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
There's no fourth.
We're going to win a Nobel Prize.
Nobel Prize for naming what a group of bacteria is.
I think something maybe like... from Wisconsin, I feel like we can find
a curd.
I was going to say a curd of
bacteria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We're on the right track.
That's gross.
Let's revisit that. Okay. I feel like I could talk about your research in bacteria for a long time, but I know there's a couple other things we wanted to talk about that are not science related, unfortunately. We haven't had a microbiologist on the show yet.
We have been talking about bacteria, which is good because you've both referenced how we like bacteria on this show.
Yeah.
We love bacteria.
So, I do. Yeah. So I'm going to hold my tongue for now. But
maybe we'll have you on some more and then we'll talk some more.
Yeah.
When we get some of this naming sorted
out, right.
We'll need to come back.
That'll be an off-air conversation.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Patent pending.
Yeah. I want to ask you, you've talked about your experience as a PhD student and as a postdoc. What's one thing you would tell yourself during those stages of your career, if you could say anything?
There's no urgency to this.
Hmm.
You know, I think, you know, I mentioned the getting the lowest score on my first microbiology exam. You know, if it hadn't occurred by then, it certainly occurred then, you know, imposter syndrome right. for me.
Yeah.
Right. So, but, you know, I took some of that with my tenacity, you know, and other traits have helped
right.
survive. Yeah. But in other ways, they've been a real hindrance, you know. So to realize that, like, no, you're smart enough to be in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And just because you're in the room doesn't mean you need to compete to be the smartest. And I usually took that as a cue to, like, yeah, just keep my mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
I should have asked more questions early on.
So ask more questions and
ask more questions.
Yeah, ask more questions.
And be confident that you belong, even if there's stuff you still don't know.
Right.
Right.
That's yeah. very good advice.
Yeah, that's really, I think you had told me something similar over the years. I also had a hard time believing I belonged in the room, and you helped me be like, no, I belong here. But even after getting a PhD, which I've had for over a year now,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, I'm a complete fraud and I don't belong here at
yeah.
all. And it's a
tough.
Really hard
and
thing.
And it never goes away.
No.
Yeah, it doesn't go away. The we did a whole episode about imposter
yeah,
syndrome,
true.
And
right.
it doesn't go away. It's I was talking to my students, actually, and we were talking about something else that doesn't go away, which is like last minute planning. And I said, you know what else doesn't go away? It's the imposter syndrome. And they were a little bit shocked.
Yeah.
And you just learn to work around it a little bit better.
You
I
do
think
work
through maturity.
And to yeah. allow yourself to enjoy the things that can be enjoyed. The numerous instances, you know, my academic training and then even being a professor, right? When I allow myself to pause and enjoy things a little bit,
right?
It's like, oh, like, I should have done this a long time ago, and not everything about this is hand-wringing and mm-hmm. need mm-hmm. to be in. Like, actually, a lot of these people are really nice,
mm-hmm. yeah.
You know, and yeah. allow your curiosity to drive it instead of your fear of somehow getting something wrong or embarrassing mm-hmm. yourself. You should ask questions. You should enjoy yourself, right? Numerous times of like. Been so focused on like, I got to get this done. I got to impress people just, mm-hmm. and like, it's usually not so necessary.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit sometimes yeah. to get over a hurdle, but mostly it's just, if you allow yourself to enjoy it, you'll be way happier and you probably get the same amount done, if not more. So to be curious and always be humble.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, yeah, just, don't worry about it quite so much. You'll enjoy it way more.
Great yeah. advice.
Yeah, you modeled that for me quite a bit as well. I remember one specific Friday, you came in the lab and you're like, you should go home and go get ice cream with your kids.
Yeah.
Just go home and do something fun, right? And I was like, oh, yeah, this is not the most important thing happening right now. That's not to say I didn't have to work hard, but I tell people that story all the time because I'm like, it's not that serious. I mean, it is. This is a lot of hard work and you have to put in the work, but
yeah.
go home and go get some, ice cream.
Ice cream, ice cream solves all the problems.
It can yeah. solve a lot of problems.
Yeah.
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 And I, that's really helped me. I mean, obviously there's stressful times where everything has to get done at the same time. That,
yeah.
that does happen.
Yeah.
But being curious and enjoying what you're doing, that showcases people like that a lot more than looking like you're super smart.
Yeah.
That spreads a lot farther. And I've taken that when I'm talking to my students now. I'm like, don't be afraid to make a mistake now. This is really low stakes for you to get something wrong. And be like, this is a chance to just ask a lot of questions and have fun and don't care about if people think it's dumb that you think it's cool. Because they probably also think it's cool.
Yeah.
And that curiosity and love for exploring, not just research, but going out and going for a walk or going to get ice cream or going to Trader Joe's. Man, that just bleeds back into your actual work. That's not always fun.
No, it's not always fun.
It's not always fun. And I think there's something that I can relate to with what you're saying about asking a lot of questions. As a graduate student, I was very much intimidated by my committee members. Those were the people who were presiding over my PhD thesis, in a sense, for our lovely listeners there. And they're all amazing, accomplished scientists, you know, much older than I was at the time. And instead of seeing it as an opportunity to learn from them, I was very intimidated by them. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something that I could have done better. Instead of going to them with what I didn't know, I felt like what I didn't know would show them that I don't belong there.
Mm. Yeah.
And so and instead of using them as a resource, as they should be.
And they probably want to be.
And they want to be, right? Because they're in the education sector, right? I saw them as obstacles to my success rather than tools to my success. And it's something that I try to tell my students now, right? You should see your classes and your professors and your research, whatever you have, as an opportunity for success rather than an obstacle to success.
So I absolutely use some of those experiences that are, you know, not the exact same as yours, but similar to yours. It's like, I need to not be a jerk. Right? I mean, like important. Sometimes they're like, you know, challenging a student to do better isn't the same as being mean about it.
Of course.
And it's easy to do both at the same time.
Yeah.
So like that's like a challenge that like I need to remind myself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, so we have one question for you. This is a question we usually start.
I know, I was going to say, I didn't start with the usual question.
The usual question, but we're gonna end on this question. I think it's appropriate. So we usually ask our guests, is there something that you are reading, watching, or listening to right now? It doesn't have to be something scientific, but something that you'd like to share with our lovely listeners.
What about, I've been listening to... a lot of 80s and 90s music.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Love that.
So, always listen to 80s music because that's formative years stuff. But in more recent weeks, I've been, going back to alternative and grunge stuff that I don't always listen to. So it's been, I haven't listened to this in a long time. So it's,
That's a
great era of music.
And I think, probably most people wouldn't expect that from me, except for my college friends. Because I still play the saxophone and I play in the university band, which is kind of straight up band literature stuff, which I also really like.
That's awesome. So you play the saxophone.
I knew you played the saxophone. I didn't.
Yeah. Okay. So my son is a much better musician than I. And a couple of years ago, we did the Notre Dame Summer Band. So and then since then, I've been doing the university band. I hadn't played in an organized group in 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Just
that's
playing
fantastic.
In the basement.
Yeah.
So I still like that kind of music, too. Mm-hmm. And people in the lab know that I will listen to marching band music. I will listen. I love all that, too.
Yeah.
But lately, it's been, not, you know, just
not marching band music.
Not marching band
80s
music.
And 90s grunge.
90s grunge.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, that is an unexpected choice for you, I feel like. I would not have guessed.
Oh, yeah. People who have maybe seen me in the last couple of weeks on my Trader Joe's walks have seen me like...
jamming out.
Yeah. Air drumming and they're probably looking at me more strangely than...
Any bands in particular from that era?
Well, I mean, got to be Nirvana and Pearl Jam, right?
Exactly.
Offspring also. Yeah.
Did you know that the lead singer of Offspring is a microbiologist?
No, I did not.
He's actually a microbiologist.
Oh, yeah, you just told me this recently.
He's actually a microbiologist. And he got a degree, I think, from California somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
A PhD, right? Did he get a PhD?
I don't remember if he got a PhD later, I think.
Oh, okay.
Later, he went back to get a PhD, but he definitely had an undergraduate degree in, I think, bacterial genetics.
I didn't know that.
And I think Offspring is kind of like an homage to the biology background.
Well, every cool
the name is.
Scientist is also a cool artist or musician of some type.
I agree.
So,
I agree too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was another professor at Notre Dame who also was in a band, Sean.
Oh, yeah.
Sean Lee.
What did he play?
A bass, usually.
Bass. Yeah.
Yeah, he played a few instruments, but usually playing bass.
Yeah. I think if you play bass, you kind of have to play other instruments because people will never take you seriously. Speaking as a bass player myself.
Yeah.
Like, you play the bass? Yeah, okay. Well, we need a guitar player to play rhythm. Okay, sure, I'll do it.
Well, when I was a grad student, I was part of a group at Iowa, and we figured out between the four of us, we had 96 years of school.
Oh, gosh.
So we were, the most overeducated.
Yeah.
You know, not a grunt, like, kind of like playing cover rock tunes, but yeah, that was.
I think that's like my soccer group. Mm-hmm. We're a very overeducated bunch, but it's actually a very diverse group as well.
Right.
We have some people who've never been to college, and we have a bunch of PhDs too.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's a fun group.
Well, I play the oboe, so nobody needs an oboe for a band. So I'm.
You can invent one.
I don't know. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
That's like the least cool instrument, I feel like, is the oboe. So nobody's like, we really need an oboe player for our gig tonight.
There's some of those British New Wave bands have bassoon parts.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
true. Okay. Maybe I'll take up a bassoon next in my spare time.
I think Ace of Base had a song where they had like some sort of either a bass saxophone or a bassoon or something.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. Well, I need to up my music game, I feel like, if I want to be a cool scientist. But. Okay, Josh, thank you so much for coming. This has been just an absolute delight. I haven't seen you in a couple months. So.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
And it's been such a pleasure. And thank you for all the advice.
Yeah. And hopefully you can come back and talk some more.
Because
I want to hear more about all the research going on. So, okay, awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listener, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. A special thanks to the wonderful people at the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences and the IU South Bend Library. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I am Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.